Welcome everyone to the Slowpokes podcast. As always, I am Slowpoke number two, David Chalante.
And I'm Slowpoke number one, John Nicolaitis.
Welcome to our final episode of 2017, yes. Where we will be looking back on our grand old year. Not so much the parts of it that are on fire,
yes,
but the parts of it that are in our wheelhouse of nerd shit,
yeah,
that we want to give a good old thumbs up to.
Yes, because we should all desperately avoid and not talk about the things that are wrong. That pause was appropriate. That joke did not land.
But no, obviously, bad stuff's happened this year.
Yeah.
But we want to take a little bit of a breath and we want to say, hey, 2017, you gave us some good stuff too.
Yeah. Here's some of that good stuff you gave us.
It's not your fault that you were taken over by the alt-right.
Yeah. No, but
no more than it's Poland's fault that it was taken over by the alt-right. So.
Oh boy. This is proving internet theories really quickly.
We're here to talk about fun stuff.
Yes,
John,
yes.
Did you have some good stuff from 2017?
Did you think
it was a good year?
I did have some good stuff. We have so many good stuff. We've got good games to talk about that we played from this year. I know.
Mean, big is subjective, okay, because most of these are small games.
Okay, so these games are small. Big movies, small games.
Yeah. Obviously, you're all familiar with the
shtick,
the gimmick of our podcast. Never has it been more apparent as we were trying to find games from this year that we'd actually played and could talk about.
So embarrassing. The list we're about to present is pretty much all of them. But I think what we'll actually do is we'll let you start, David.
Yes. So of the 2017 games I've actually played, one of them was a massive standout for me, and I don't think many of you are going to be surprised by this. That is the game by Supergiant, Pyre. You've mm-hmm. played Pyre as well, haven't
yes.
you, John?
Yes, we played it roughly around the same time, actually, yeah, when it came out. I think we were both very excited. We were like, oh, this is the Bastion and the Transistor people. They're making a new game. Oh, it looks just as beautiful. Oh, please be good.
Yeah, and this is more Supergiant than Supergiant's ever been. Transistor, I felt, was a step down from Bastion. I thought Bastion was a superior game. Transistor is still very, very interesting, but there were some pacing issues and stuff that just didn't really work for me, whereas this game is so perfectly a distilled example of what Supergiant does. There's amazing character work,
yep,
just beautiful, like mind-blowingly good writing, some of the best writing that I've seen in games in a long time.
Yeah,
and of course the artistic vista, just the scape of both sound and visual, like what the thing looks like and sounds like and feels like moment to moment is just absolutely fucking flawless.
I mean, I haven't revisited this game in a while, and I can still remember the hand-drawn vistas and the places that you go to and how they look and felt to be in.
Yeah.
It's just so clear in my mind, these worlds.
Yeah, you're kind of hitting on something that is really beautiful about this game, is there are many games that have very heavy-handed world building,
yeah,
but actually feel quite small, whereas this is just, you know, what is outside the frame is just colossal and infinite, and they allude to it just so deftly. And I want to come back to this, but again, just how well written it is, like how incredibly well written it is. And of course, like most Supergiant games, there is one voiced character in the whole thing, and that voiced character is an excellent performer.
Yep.
Who's the music person? Darren Korb.
Yes, of course it is.
Absolutely destroys everything. Yep. Like the soundtrack.
Yeah, the soundscape is just as beautiful as the visuals itself. If you looked at a picture of Pyre, you could expect the quality of the audio to match it.
Yeah, or exceed it. And it's one of these things where, you know, there are some games that just take a little moment to land, but what it sounded like and what it looked like and what I was reading from these characters and the crispness and smoothness of every element of play and every element of the interface.
Yeah.
Within 5 minutes of turning it on, I'm just sitting here going, this is going to be amazing.
Yeah,
what I'm looking at here is amazing.
Yeah, you're right. Like from zero to start, that is such a short amount of time. And every piece of the design is working towards making that like a fluid transition into just being absorbed by it.
It was nominated for a Game of the Year award. It was beaten out by Cuphead, which I think is a crime, despite never having played Cuphead.
Oh, but David.
Now, honestly, like, you know, I can't judge a game that I haven't played, but it is unimaginable to me that a game could be more perfectly what it wants to be than this.
Yeah.
Other examples that are on this tier are like Firewatch and Undertale and Life is Strange.
Yeah.
Like games that are just such perfect expressions of what artistic vision is. And it's so beautiful to see any game do it, but especially an indie game just come together so well.
It'd be so, I would recommend anyone check it out, really. Even if the gameplay, which is an odd sports-esque style arena system.
Yeah, and I hate saying that because it sounds so bad, but it's so good.
For me, I remember playing the really simplified sports games in like Mario Party, and it's both as easy to play as that, but as complex as any other strategy game you might encounter.
It's a good balance between complexity and depth, and it just flows so well and looks so great and feels so satisfying to play. Check it out. If you haven't checked out anything else that Supergiant's done, check out their stuff as well.
Yep.
Now, John, why don't you throw at me one of your good games from this year?
One of my good games. I am going to break the list up, and I'm going to mention Cuphead.
Cuphead. Now, I've not played Cuphead. No. But everybody I know who has played it absolutely loves it, except critics.
So, I mean, there's been so much critic bashing around this game, especially in the news.
It makes me roll my eyes. Like, it's hard, that's awesome, but if someone has criticisms of it, it's not because they, quote, need to get good.
So, for me, when I saw Cuphead, like the trailers for Cuphead, I, like almost anybody with eyes and a sense of nostalgia, was taken away by the old-timey feel, the similarities to those old racist cartoons that Disney used to make but wants you to forget about, and just that wonderful, like, classic, crisp, celluloid visual appeal. Mm. And that's what got me excited.
For me, I was never grabbed by that for two reasons. One, the racist thing that you just said.
Yes.
And second, I've mentioned this before, but the whole clowns thing, where for some reason I associate this with horror, not with the thing that it originally was.
Okay, yeah.
I really do appreciate that it is unique, and it does look very, very striking.
The second thing is that everyone started going on about that game was going to be so hard.
Yeah.
And I rolled my eyes so hard that they flew out of my head and they just left. They went sightseeing around the world because I could not care about that.
This is the question. Is it actually hard, or is it made in such a way that people who think that shores up their identity in some way won't get angry at it for not being hard enough?
So in my opinion, the game is about learning the patterns that it presents to you.
Yeah, because it's just the boss fights, right?
Yes.
So if you die, you immediately go back to the start of whatever boss fight it was. So effectively, even though it doesn't technically have checkpoints,
It does, right?
Because
you can just go back to the start of every boss fight. And if you play with two players, one person can revive the other. But yeah, when people start talking about it being hard, that's not too exciting. An interesting challenge? Yeah, sure. But just being hard for hard's sake, it's not that interesting. It is challenging to play. But the game gives you difficulty options within itself as well as...
Okay.
The people who made Cuphead understand how to convey the language of these games.
Yeah. And so the fact that it's also got difficulty levels in it, then that's awesome. All of the crap that I've been complaining about, it's not about the game, it's about the fucking fans.
Yeah, yeah. And that's the problem. The game is lovely. And it was really hyped up by Microsoft. And whenever I went to PAX, I would always see it in the booths and people would be talking about it. And it feels like a game like No Man's Sky in that it's like it would be a wonderfully beautiful little indie game, but it was like really inflated via hype.
Yeah, I think that this one is actually protected by its indie game status, though, and I feel it also delivered on the promises that it made, at least as far as I can read the audience.
Yeah, yeah. But I quite like it. I love playing it in just little short bursts. I'll jump in, fight a boss or two, and just go do something else.
I really do admire that as well, that it's just the boss fights too, because it's like, make the best part of your game.
Yeah.
You know what I mean? Don't pad it. I really, really respect that it isn't given more content for the sake of content.
I used to love playing JRPGs and those kind of things, especially on handheld devices, but I just don't have time to grind through things if you just have what I want, which in this case is just fighting bosses and learning their patterns. Great. Have a great time.
The next game on our list is one that you actually suggested to me, and that's Subsurface Circular, which is made by one of my preferred developers. An indie developer I really like, Mike Bethel, who is famous for Thomas Was Alone, and less famous, but also known for Volume.
Yes.
Now, Volume is interesting because that's actually on our list for next season, so I'm looking forward to playing that. But Subsurface Circular, again, such a great example of an idea very efficiently realized. He describes it as a short rather than, you know, like a full project.
Yes.
And I can understand why. And that was a smart plan because it does forgive some of the lack of depth. Mm. It's much more like a visual novel than anything else, but it's this beautiful little game about sentient artificial intelligences mm-hmm. living in the real world and what that means for them. And yeah. I don't want to say much more than that because it ruins it,
yeah.
but it's fucking brilliant.
You basically play a detective robot that's circling a subway, mm. A subsurface, if you will,
yeah.
where, but basically he sits on the subway and talks to people.
Yeah.
And talks to other robots.
You as this character can't leave the train for yeah. in-game reasons, but you have to solve a mystery.
Mm-hmm.
And the mystery itself is compelling enough, but it does ask some mid to high level, you know, sci-fi questions about yep. the nature of AI and the nature of governance and that kind of thing.
Mm-hmm.
Set in the same world as Thomas Was Alone yeah. and Volume.
Apparently,
so I didn't realize
yeah.
both of them were all in the same world, but they're all in the same universe.
Yeah, yeah, which is cute. I liked yeah. it.
AI questions is one of my preferred sci-fi topics.
David's thing, AI and time travel.
The fact that it's got some fun questions about AI and that philosophical stuff, it's really, really good. And it's short, it's cheap, it's fast, and it's
yeah. if you,
made by a very talented artist.
Yeah, if you want to play something short that has really great writing and just the coolest looking sci-fi robots back behind everything,
mm.
just have a look, have a listen, have a play. So shocking me was I actually played a shooter this year, right? And not just some narrative-based experience or something from 5 years ago. I
object to John's use of just before narrative experience, everyone.
Okay. Why don't I think about the things that come out of my mouth?
That's what the alt-right does, John, so good on you. Anyway, you played a violent shooter about blood and guts this year with a white male protagonist.
Lie. You can choose.
Oh, cool. That's yeah. awesome.
So, anyway.
I already like Prey better.
Lambasting me aside, I did play Prey this year, which is a remake of a very old shooter from the 90s.
When you say remake, is it a reboot?
It's a reboot.
I guess, okay, because I honestly don't know.
You know what? I guess it's really just a game that used a name from an old game that's completely different in almost every way. I honestly don't know why it's called Prey. Anyway, it's like Bioshock set in space. Basically, you play as Morgan Wu and you're a scientist on the... I can't remember what the facility called. It has something like Gargantua or whatever.
Oh, it's going to have a reference to Moby Dick or some shit like
yeah, yeah.
that.
And it was like built in a different era where the space race went differently. And like,
yeah.
it's a space station from the 1950s. So there's ashtrays everywhere and stuff like that. Even though it is set in
the
2000s.
That's the first thing I think of when I think yeah. of the 50s is ashtrays.
It's
back when smoking and racism was okay.
Yeah. And what symbolizes that better than ashtrays? It's one of those games where it's like, it gives you a bunch of different tools to interact with your environment. But the thing that sold me is that the very basic enemy, the mimics, mimic everyday objects.
Oh, cool.
And it's like such a gimmick that is so adorable to me and scares me every time.
When you say they mimic them, are they fully properly camouflaged
yes.
as the object? So it's a good avenue for jump scares.
Yeah, yeah, yeah. But because the objects are like perfect replicas of them as well, mm. you'll just see two mugs sitting next to each other.
Right.
And stuff like that. And it turns every...
There was an episode of Round the Twist that was this.
Yeah.
They had some mushrooms that did this exact thing and it's awesome and I love it.
Any game that can make me kick every chair in fear, I just found enjoyable. And the enemy is like this kind of ambiguous space entity,
mm.
which some people don't like, but I kind of do.
Yeah.
I'm always a fan of the faceless aliens that are unknowable and just want to murderize you or turn you into paste.
Yeah.
And I found it a very enjoyable playthrough and the gameplay style is interesting.
Yeah, it's kind of an 0451 game, right? Like Bioshock and
yes.
that kind of thing.
Yeah, yeah, it's basically a different style of Bioshock.
Yeah.
yeah.
So it's that genre.
Mm-hmm.
So it is one of those ones that I'm halfway interested in, but there's just so much more that was higher on the list for me this
yeah.
year, and I still only got to like 5 games.
Yeah, yeah. And I think that's fair. I quite enjoyed Prey because the original Bioshock, I didn't get all the way through it. I really
yeah.
failed to interface with it completely, and I just had a better time with Prey. It was just more of my style.
Yeah.
You know? But yeah, I quite enjoyed it, so I would recommend anyone checking it out, especially if you can catch it cheap. So.
Yeah, I'm going to try and squeeze it in. So another game that you actually put me onto this year that mm-hmm. I really liked was Stories Untold.
Yes, I actually had a spare copy and I gave it to you. That's why.
That's how it happened. Yeah, that's
wondering.
How I wound up with that.
Yeah.
But this was a great game. Did I play that on Halloween? I think I played it on Halloween.
I hope so, because that's amazing.
No, I made my dad play it on Halloween.
You're
yes!
You're a monster, apparently. Hey, Dad, be scared.
Yeah, but it's a really awesome game. If you're a fan of movies like It or like Stranger Things, yeah. or even maybe sort of tangentially Thor Ragnarok and stuff like that.
I feel like they retroactively added in Stranger Things stylings to the game.
This is the thing, right? This year we've had a big push, and Lindsay Ellis did a video on this, back to this specific sort of reimagining of this archetype of what the 80s is and what 80s media is, this kind of romanticized version of it. And that's where we get things like Stranger Things and It and all of those. They're mm-hmm. capturing this kind of, what was the term she used? Sort of this 80s synth dream or something like that. And Stories Untold fits into this style of it very, very well, except rather than focusing on shows like The Goonies or whatever, which it does a little bit of, it's more focused on, at the very least in the first episode of it, games from that era.
Yeah.
So it's broken into four episodes. The first episode is this text adventure style game on one of those old cassette driven computers.
Which you can play for free.
The first episode's free?
The first episode is free.
If you have time, the whole game plays in like an hour. So, yeah. I mean, each episode would be 10 to 15 minutes long.
Yeah.
And they all have these little 80s tactile gimmicks. So yes. The first episode has the cassette-driven computer with the
keyboard and the text adventure game on it.
The
text adventure interface.
The second one has you doing like these experiments, but with tech from that time.
Yeah,
so it's
yeah.
all very analog and yeah. very nice to yeah. the look and to the quote touch.
Yeah, and like the whole game is like that. I would really want to not talk about it too much because I think the joy in playing this game is just being presented with these interesting situations and learning them and playing through them narratively.
Yeah, exactly. What's worth mentioning is that it is a horror game and it does horror quite well.
Yeah.
There are some conceits. And again, you only need to play the first episode before you're completely hooked. So
yeah.
pick up that free version of it if you can. Mm-hmm. Play that first episode. Really clever in some of the things that it does to mess with you and make you afraid.
Yeah, I honestly didn't know where it came out of. It just appeared on my radar and I played through it with a good friend of the show, Ollie.
Yeah.
So I had just a lovely time.
Just on my own sort of reactions to the game,
yeah.
and I think most people feel this way.
Hmm.
It's amazingly good. I'm so glad I played it. The fourth episode is probably the weakest of all of them, and it's
yeah.
a bit of a shame that the game ends on its weakest link.
Yeah. yeah.
But for its length and for what it is, it's much better than I had any right to expect it to be.
Yeah.
And so it's very, very good.
Endings are hard.
Hmm.
So those were the very short amount of games that we
yeah,
played.
A completely underwhelming number of video games.
Don't look into it. But now we're going to talk about movies that we watched and saw this year.
We're not
year.
Talking about Star Wars.
Everybody,
calm down.
We were going to mention that we watched Star Wars.
Yeah, we've both seen it, but we're not going to talk about it. We're not going to ruin it. Trust us. It's fine. Star Wars happened 3 days ago as we record
okay,
this.
Yep.
We're not talking about it.
Yep.
Relax.
Okay. I liked it. I'm not going to say any more. I'm done.
Other movies that we actually can talk about that we
yes.
have a little bit more distance with. One that we covered already on the show was Logan, which
yes.
was a very surprisingly good X-Men movie that came out this year.
After Wolverine Origins and the mixed
Apocalypse,
one
with- Apocalypse, yeah.
No, I didn't see Apocalypse. The one where he was in Japan. That was like, eh. But like after those movies, I was kind of like, I just need to put this to bed now. This just needs to be done. But
And then along came a movie to do that for us.
And you know what I love? I love it when a text can be like, we're done now.
Yeah.
Full stop.
But you fucking know that. I mean, admittedly, Disney just bought the rights to Wolverine back
yes.
for more money than most nations possess.
Yeah, that's true.
So hopefully they'll be respectful. I don't know, but I doubt it.
Or they just get someone else to play him.
Like, oh, yeah. Hugh Jackman's not coming back.
Yeah.
We all know that.
I don't mind if they try and reboot.
I want to see a movie that focuses on Daphne Keene's character, X-23, Laura.
Mm-hmm.
Because I have had my Logan journey.
Yes.
Hugh Jackman will always be the screen Wolverine, just as much as Christopher Reeve will always be the screen Superman.
Yes.
And it's really interesting, the movie Logan as a whole, because it allows, like you said, Hugh Jackman to end it, the character to end on his terms in a meaningful way.
Yeah, to me, that's kind of a thing in our culture right now. I always hear people talking about something new and something continuing, but I never hear about people talk about something ending.
Yeah.
And it was so satisfying to have death and end to something. And to it be so impactful and wonderful as Logan was.
Yeah, and it's an amazingly good movie. There's been talk about it potentially being nominated for an Oscar.
Great.
And it would be the first superhero movie. I don't know if it's going to be the first one to be nominated for an Oscar, but a lot of people are talking about it being the first one that has a real chance of winning an Oscar. And there's good things and bad things in that. The main thing that's kind of annoying is that it is very much an anti-genre film. It subverts the genre of superhero films in very, very specific ways, and is ultimately just a Western, which is great because Westerns are cool too. And if you want to get old people to vote for an Oscar movie, you make it a fucking Western that they remember from their childhood.
And Westerns are all secretly samurai movies, which are just as awesome.
So I'd be happy to see it win because it's an amazing movie. I mean, if nothing else, Patrick Stewart deserves a fucking Oscar for his performance in it. It's the best thing I've seen him on screen.
Patrick Stewart just deserves Oscars.
Yeah, he just deserves every Oscar.
That's just a pile of Oscars.
But, I made this comment in our own episode on Logan. Sometimes you see big name actors show up in stuff that on paper should be beneath them.
Yes.
And they come in, they do their work, they kind of sleepwalk through it a little bit, but they're still great because they're good at what they do.
Yeah.
He shows up in this movie. He is so there and he is performing every fucking second of it. And it shows and it's amazing. In this really wanted it to succeed, I feel. And it did and it deserved to.
We need to stop talking about it because I'm going to start crying. It's too much.
But yeah, if you haven't checked out Logan, check it out.
So another movie that I saw this year that I didn't actually expect to get around to watching was Baby Driver.
Edgar Wright, y'all.
Yeah. So I watched a video from Movies with Mikey about Hot Fuzz, of all things.
Yeah, the Cornetto trilogy.
Yeah, and he was talking about how like Hot Fuzz was such a great movie and all of Edgar Wright as like a director. And then I watched a whole bunch of videos about Baby Driver and I decided to go watch it.
Mm.
And it has a lot of his directorial work in there that makes him so interesting. And yeah. I found it really fun. Just a really fun movie.
Yeah. Edgar Wright is an amazing filmmaker.
Yeah.
And if you haven't seen the Movies with Mikey episode on The World's End either, you should check that one out too, because that's another incredible movie by him. Shaun of the Dead, you know, it's an opener. It's one of his earlier works. I think it's fine, but I think he's done so much more since then.
Mm-hmm.
And Baby Driver is an excellent example of the just style brought to film, like a very specific kind of style brought to film.
I think it was Nerdwriter I was watching. As you can tell, Dave and I watch a lot of videos that talk about movies that we love. but they were talking about how in Baby Driver, every character has their own, they're color coded and they have own colored outfits. And Baby has he's very black and white in his outfits in the beginning. And as the film moves forward, his shirt gets gray to represent him moving through the morality of the film.
Yeah.
And it's those kind of attentions to details that make Edgar Wright an interesting director.
No,
for me.
It's brilliant. Like everything he does has a lot going on in it. Mm-hmm. And this film's no exception. I think that one thing that is very cleverly put together is the love interest character whose name I can't remember off the top of my head.
Deborah.
Yeah.
Because it rhymes with zebra.
And it's also in songs, right? There's references to songs.
Yeah. I was referencing one of the songs.
Definitely. You have this character that comes in as this sort of idealized love interest mother figure. And, like, on paper, you're just like, oh, God, if you read films like me with any kind of feminist critique, it's like, oh, here we go. But it is purposeful and it moves and evolves into something by the end of the film. And the film itself goes from a very black and white clear thing to a mess, like an absolute mess by the end of it.
Yeah.
And a lot of people were disappointed by the ending. Again, it's all done with purpose and it's amazingly layered and amazingly deep.
I don't know. The satisfaction I felt at the end of the movie, sure, it's not like the triumph and joy that I feel like a lot of people want from things, but I found it satisfying the way it ends.
See, I think that might be a difference between the way you and I read relationships. You might have walked away from that feeling that he reached some kind of emotional health or emotional catharsis. I felt that he leaned into his emotional dysfunction. And that's part of why that made me quite uncomfortable with the ending.
Sure.
But again, that's the beauty of art. You can read it in different ways.
Oh.
Also, Don Draper's in it, so check it out.
What? Don Draper?
Yeah, John Hamm. Oh, plays my God. The John other Hamm. Driver.
I love John Hamm. Yes. That was a thing I would have said.
Yeah. Also Jamie Foxx. So yeah.
Yeah. Good cast. Oh, Jamie Foxx. And also who shall not be named anymore.
Yeah, that one.
We just won't name him. I like that.
So, one of the most acclaimed movies that came out this year that John hasn't seen...
Because I'm terrible.
...is the directorial debut of Jordan Peele, Get Out, which was, I think, the highest grossing horror film until It beat it later in the year.
Yes.
But, I saw that literally 3 or 4 days ago in preparation for this episode, because it's one I've been meaning to see for ages. I love Key. I love Peele. I love any of the works that they've done, either together or apart.
And I didn't watch it because I'm terrible at my job.
But, no, it's good. Yeah. And it is good. Yep. It lives up to the hype.
It looks good. Sometimes you can watch like a trailer and a cut together of a film and it's like, this is revealing nothing, but getting me excited.
Yeah. One thing I will say before we go into this is I am a white man talking about this movie and it is very specifically about the black experience in America, but probably more broadly.
Mm-hmm.
So I confess my ignorance. I apologize for any mistakes I'm about to make.
Yeah.
But I think one of the things that's really impressive about the movie is the way it handles tone and atmosphere as it goes through. A lot of people talked about this movie as though it was a comedy, and I can see where they're coming from, both because Peele is known for that and also because of the way it handles satire.
Mm.
But being satirical, I don't think necessarily makes it move into the realm of comedy as opposed to horror.
Really? What kind of people were talking about it being a comedy?
It wasn't that many, and I don't remember their names off the top of my head, but it was a bit of a conversation that was happening on the side.
Mm.
My main avenue into that conversation was people I respect criticizing it being called a comedy. But I think that what's also interesting about this is, and again, this is where we come into the whole white man part of the conversation.
Yep. Flagged. Keep going.
When we talk about genre, genres are conventions that are agreed upon sort of by cultural consensus.
Yeah.
And when you move into different cultures, the way genres are defined is different. And I think that some white critics looked at the way this film was put together and couldn't slot it so neatly into the white audience understanding of what horror is, and so wanted to call it something more like comedy, right? Which isn't inherently satire, racist, but it is judging something by your own culture's standards.
Mm.
When I look at this, I look at it as having different genre conventions and it having a different conception of where the boundaries of horror are. And that's one of the more fascinating things about it. So it does a lot of really interesting stuff from a genre perspective. It does a lot of interesting stuff from a social sort of justice or social awareness perspective. And also it's just a genuinely upsetting kind of horror. Something that some people have described it as is a social horror.
Mm.
And, you know, I've not seen The Stepford Wives, but I'm sure that there are probably people screaming into their headsets right now.
Yeah.
It's an homage to The Stepford Wives because it does, at the very least, have intertextuality with it, if not necessarily being a direct remake or homage to it. But it does play with expectations very well.
That sounds exciting. I am going to go watch it after this episode, so...
Yeah. Also, check out Keanu if you haven't.
So, the next movie that is on our list is Guardians of the Galaxy Volume 2.
Now, this is a contender for me for Movie of the Year.
Wow, okay.
Yeah, I loved this. I loved the original Guardians.
Yeah.
Before Guardians 2 came out, Guardians 1 was easily the best superhero movie I've seen.
I was actually pretty much one of the favorite of the Marvel films for me, yeah.
Then we had two strong contenders to it. Three, I guess, if you count the sequel to itself this year in Logan and Thor Ragnarok.
Yeah.
But Guardians Volume 2 is another example of sort of like we were talking about with Baby Driver or with Edgar Wright.
Mm.
It's another example of a movie that just has so much going on so many different levels.
Not only is it just a visual feast for the eyes, and like they really go into that over-the-top eye candy kind of stuff. They're like, how can we do this scene? But with diamonds, or, you know.
Hey, you know that color that you've never heard of? Here's a million more like that.
Yeah, and just like the crispness of everything. I feel like they really told an interesting story around the character of Peter Quill and how just messed up it would be to be abducted by pirate slavers who threaten to eat you all the time.
Yeah. One of the, again, this is another movie that Lindsay Ellis has done a much more comprehensive take on than either of us can vocalize.
Especially in 3 minutes.
Yeah. But she talked a lot about how the movie explores trauma and different kinds of trauma and the post-stress of trauma in the form of PTSD that most of the characters have. I mean, Gamora and Nebula both sort of explore the after effects of domestic violence and child abuse. You've got Peter Quill, who also has elements of that as well, abusive parents and the complex relationships that people have with their abusive parents, that, mm-hmm. you know, knowing that what they did to you was wrong doesn't necessarily mean you stop loving them on some level. Yeah. It's just Rocket obviously has a lot of issues with his whole past.
Bringing and, people close to him and trusting and
intimacy
people.
And I think that a term that Lindsay Ellis used was that he's literally triggered in the psychological sense by condescension. Mm. And when you go back and watch the movie with that realization, yeah. it just it totally recontextualizes my relationship with his behavior.
Yeah.
And so every character has just so much going on top of all of the amazing just
action beats.
And incredibly punchy dialogue and comedy. It's amazing work. James Gunn is an incredible director, and his brother does an amazing job as the Ravager guy.
What? Is it the one who
does, the adorable Ravager.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah, that's James Gunn's brother, who has a first name that I can't remember.
Oh, no. Well, we're terrible with names, but I quite liked it. I thought it was really good. And for those Marvel movies, like, it's trying to do interesting things, and that's what I want to see these movies do.
Mm.
Just like the next movie we're going to talk about.
Our next film is Thor Ragnarok.
Yes, this one looks so inspired by Guardians of the Galaxy Volume 2. Yeah. And also 2007 word clip art.
So the director of this movie is a New Zealand-born man, and John, I'm going to leave it to you to pronounce his name.
Is it Taika Waititi?
Taika Waititi,
oh,
yes.
Good, nailed it. Who looks and talks like an angel. Like, I watch every interview with him, and it's amazing.
Yeah,
it's
he
so
seems just like a really rad person. I found out earlier today that he did an ad about combating racism in New Zealand, which does not surprise me at all, because he just seems like the most coolest dude ever.
Yep.
Now, you've not seen Thor Ragnarok, have
you? No.
So not only does it do all the amazing 80s synth fever dream stuff that we all love and crave.
Yes.
It's also got Jeff Goldblum in it.
Yeah,
who does
that.
A lot more of that. But it also does a lot of interesting stuff with queer subtext.
Hello.
Yeah, so a lot of people who saw this movie walked away a little bit disappointed with the revelation that Valkyrie is bisexual because it's not made explicit. And I can empathize with that. But by the same token, that doesn't erase the specific kind of language in this film. Now, again, I'm straight, can't comment on this with authority.
Yep.
But there are some people who have expressed great admiration for the queering of the movie as a whole, and it's sort of like the fundamental language of the film. And also, I've seen at least one person say that they like the fact that it's a kind of queering that mostly only queer people will get.
Yeah.
And so it's much more for them in a specific way than it is about, you know, making a proclamation on behalf of them. Does that make sense?
Yeah, it's not something that's put into kind of a thing where it's like, oh, this is here, so cis people can be like, yeah, we like the queers. Look, they're there with us.
And yeah.
We can kind of appreciate them that way.
It isn't about making straight people feel better about it.
Yeah.
It's
genuinely for people who are queer.
Yeah. And there are things that are in there that aren't made with consideration to the straight ability to detect it.
Hmm.
But on top of that, it's got all the amazing stuff that every Marvel movie has. Good action, good comedy, big colors, big explosions.
It's also got Mark Ruffalo as a Hulk in it.
Yep. The Ruffalo Buffalo.
So that's good. That's good stuff.
Yeah, no, it's awesome. Like I said, Guardians Volume 1 was easily my best Marvel movie.
Yep.
Our best superhero movie made. And this year we had three other movies that really challenge it for the throne. So
yeah, definitely.
Onwards and upwards as far as Marvel's concerned.
So a reboot? Reissue? Sequel?
It's a sequel. Just a sequel. You know that it's a sequel, right?
Yeah,
I You're the one who saw it.
Yeah, that's true.
It's Blade Runner, everyone.
Yeah, it's Blade Runner.
Blade Runner. Jared Leto, Ryan Gosling.
Ryan Gosling.
Are you hooked yet?
Yeah.
Because I said Jared Leto and Ryan Gosling.
I was hooked by the Ryan Gosling, not by the Jared Leto. Even though he is good in it.
Yeah.
But yeah, I wanted to watch this movie because the director made two films that I really enjoyed. Arrival and Sicario.
Now, I've not seen Sicario yet, but Arrival was one of the best movies of 2016 easily.
Yep.
It's an amazing movie.
Yeah. The director has such a great sense of style, and he carries the style from the original films through in this one, and then he adds interesting new world things that you feel would fit into the world of Blade Runner, this kind of post-apocalypse kind of place where everyone's crammed in together. And it's just so satisfying to get back into the whole synthetic robot cyborg world and all of that sort of double guessing and double thinking and not sure. The text is a little bit easier to understand, but I don't know if that's a bad thing, to be honest.
Yeah, and well, this is the thing I was going to say. I rewatched the original Blade Runner in anticipation for seeing this movie. The thing about the original Blade Runner that sort of surprised me on its reviewing is that the plot and even some of the themes that it explores are less deep than I was expecting. Obviously, it codified all of this shit that we see much more nuanced ways in things like Deus Ex Human Revolution and stuff like that. And I am very interested in seeing how 2049 tackles similar ideas however many decades on.
Yeah.
I know you shouldn't judge anything by its trailer, but one thing that I was very happy to see was sort of that happening with the visual side of it, that it had a very similar visual language, at least in a lot of the ways the shots were shown in the trailer, but in just the best, like, most awesome high definition and with sort of a contemporary eye and shot structure, but still with that attitude of shots.
Yeah.
Of, like, I think there's one from the trailers where there's rain pouring down the front of the camera, just stuff like that that's so Blade Runner.
Every scene is wonderfully shot. It shows you the beauty that a good cinematographer and the setting can do.
You know that one scene with the large holographic model that Ryan Gosling looks at? That's not CGI.
What?
Yeah, that's some like projection technique that they use with like forced perspective and stuff. But it's not CGI.
That's great. Because for a modern reboot, like the original film was so interesting visually because a lot of the effects were done in camera, right? Like the spaceship you see at the start flying through the cityscape is like, it uses models.
Oh, cool.
And like layered projection to get this effect.
Yeah. Which if you've seen the non-remastered Star Wars, is probably looks a little bit familiar to you.
Oh, yeah. Which is just like amazing stuff. It can make a movie look timeless if you get those miniatures just right. I feel like there was just some similar things done than this. It was well worth the watch. I was so excited. Also it has John Batista in it.
Oh, really?
Yeah, just for the start. He's just there in the intro. It's real cool.
Do you mean Dave Bautista?
Do I mean Dave Bautista?
The guy who plays Drax?
Yes.
Yeah,
Dave. I'm pretty sure
it's Dave.
Let's double check. No, David, he's John. He's a John. No.
I'm pretty sure my name is the wrestler guy's name.
No.
And I'm definitely right.
Oh, no.
That's very funny, actually.
Who's John Batista?
It's no one.
Projecting aside, I always like seeing good character actors in there. And also, I really like Ryan Gosling when he's brooding and quiet.
Yeah, when Ryan Gosling is cast and directed well, he does good work.
Actually, now I think about it, I like a lot of the films, the character films that Ryan Gosling did.
I think it's worth mentioning at this point, part of the reason people don't like him is because women like him. So a lot of the backlash that we see against him isn't actually because of his limited range.
I think you're right.
Yeah, I mean, he was really, really good in the one with Russell Crowe.
Yeah, that's the one I was going to mention. I think it's called
The Nice Guys.
The Nice Guys. That's a great film.
Yeah, that's a really good movie.
Yeah, and he's amazing in it. Him and his daughter as well, who does a wonderful performance. But yeah, I think that's the reason. It's like, sexism gets us all somehow. The final movie for this year that I saw, which shocks me that I saw it all, is It.
Yeah, now I've not seen this. Mm-hmm. You made a comment earlier in the year.
I do make comments.
Any Stephen King property that's turned into a movie under Stephen King's direction is garbage.
Yep.
How does that work with your theory?
I quite liked this movie. So I have a feeling that Stephen King's involvement was very small.
Well, most people did like this movie.
Yeah.
Now, from what I understand, this is a two-parter?
Yes.
So the original
Surprise!
Book, It, takes place partly in the 50s and partly in the 80s.
Mm-hmm.
This one takes all of the stuff that would have been in the 50s and puts it in the 80s as one long movie.
Yes.
And now the next movie is going to be in the current day, and that's going to be all the stuff that would have happened in the 80s.
Yeah. Yeah.
Cool. That's all I know about this, and I really want to see it now.
Yeah. Basically, I think they took a lot of cues from what Stranger Things has done.
Yeah, they're capitalizing on, like I was saying earlier, this 80s resurgence.
But they understand, like, they're not, I think it's really well balanced. I think the film is really interesting, and it's a scary horror film, but I don't think it would be as scary as Get Out would be. It's more of what I would call like a pop horror.
Yeah.
Even though some of those moments with that fucking clown are just no fun for anybody.
Yeah.
See,
it doesn't surprise me that that would be the case. Horror has always been an interesting genre because of where it sits on that scale.
Yeah.
there are horror movies that are designed to be kind of laughed along with while still being horror. They're more like roller coasters. And then there are horrors that are designed to be truly and deeply upsetting and make us ask really uncomfortable questions about ourselves and the world. And a lot of the more commercially successful horrors, I find, sit on the more comfortable end of that scale, which I think is awesome, but they're not generally the horrors that I like.
Yeah.
And I think that that's part of what didn't really capture me about it, is that I'm looking at it going, damn it, is every horror for the next 5 years just going to be trying to ape Stranger Things? And I think that that's unfair of me. It's selling the movie short. I'm sure it's doing a lot of interesting things, and I definitely need to see it. We'll see how I feel about it afterwards, I guess. But Stephen King is good at what he does,
They've taken out the parts that are terrible, the weird children sex scenes that's in the original book and other stuff like that. There's some weird stuff in the original book. Stephen King was on cocaine when he wrote some of his stories. That's a known fact. And also, when it gets to the end of the movie and there's basically the revelation that it's not over, I did not feel cheated. If they're breaking this off into two distinct parts and the second movie is all about the second half and it finishes, I'm not worried about that at all. I don't feel cheated. The first film itself, unlike a series like The Hobbit, for example, which feels like a stretch to put it to three films, this was just a complete film and a complete story that didn't feel like it was hamstrung at all.
And that matters so much. Yeah, it doesn't surprise me at all that you wouldn't be cheated by that. It doesn't, just the mere concept of it didn't even occur to me that it would be stretched out before you said it, you know?
Yeah, and I felt like after watching this film and what they wanted to do with it, I'm like, oh, it would have hamstrung the movie and the story they were trying to tell. They would have to have removed so much enjoyment out of the film to get it to be one film. So I'm very interested in the second part, and I really quite enjoyed it.
So we're going to pivot away from movies now because we've talked about quite a lot, by far the longest list of things we've done, because that takes the least time.
Apparently going to a place and sitting down for 2 to 3 hours is very easy to do.
Yeah. So the TVs that we saw this week, in the week of 2017.
We see time differently to you mortals.
The TV that we saw this year is a little bit of a shorter list, but we wanted to start with something we've covered relatively recently, and that was The Punisher.
Yeah.
John, you are a big fan of The Punisher in a broad conceptual sense, I understand.
Thank you for softening that. I am a fan of these anti-heroes as well. I'm a big fan of Max Payne and also where that series of games from 1 to 3 took the character. And The Punisher, to me, fits into that kind of vein of character, especially when he is... when, like, the evils of what he does is played up.
Yeah.
And which I think the show does, and as we discussed, not as much as we'd want, but it still makes an attempt at it. I think a pretty good one.
I think it does better than it could have. It isn't jingoistic. It isn't just, like, the movie called Shooter, which I think is that a Mark Wahlberg movie?
It is a Mark Wahlberg movie.
It's not American Sniper. You know
what
I mean?
He's a good 9/11 truther. I'm pretty sure.
But a bad person, just in general.
Yes.
Bad dude, Mark Wahlberg.
He's done some bad things.
Yeah. But
career.
This is a lot more nuanced than it could have been. And I didn't expect it to be anywhere near that bad. But one of the things I think is interesting about it is how many people seem to think this show takes a stance against guns.
Yeah.
Which I feel it definitely does not.
See our previous episode on that.
The main character uses guns because he's a good guy with a gun. There are several explicit moments where a person who we know is a good guy is in trouble because they don't have a gun.
That, to me, that's like the biggest one. That's like not only like the main, as
like
Punisher,
how deliberately explicit the shots are.
Yeah.
The close up on her moment of realization of, oh no, if only I had my gun.
And also the implicit expectation of when they set that up. Like you're already like, oh no.
Yeah.
And I think to me, like, making the Punisher a good guy with a gun is like a mistake you can make.
Yeah.
But then setting up the rest of the show with all of these things, that's when it's like really
and
a problem.
I hate to use this as an excuse, but there are conceits of genre that we forgive and we don't necessarily tie them as explicitly to a political message. I don't think you have to bend over backwards that hard to try and justify the Punisher using guns to do his whole crusade and have me go, oh, this is a pro-gun show. Like you said, it's the shit outside that. Beyond that, though, it's just a very well-acted and well-paced series. John Bernthal plays...
That's where the John came from. Yeah, John Bernthal.
John Bernthal plays the Punisher, and he is very well cast at it. There's one or two directorial moments where I was just like, maybe in this scene, he doesn't need to scream quite as much.
As someone who used to do martial arts and is very used to the sound of men and women grunting.
Grunt screaming.
I don't know what you're talking about. It seems totally normal.
But like by the second or third last episode, there are moments where you're hearing him do his grunt scream and you're like, guys, you've exhausted it by this point. Yep. It's too much.
You gotta marshal the grunt scream. It needs to be at moments of...
You need to be considered with your grunt screaming.
Yes. Yeah, one cannot just fill a show with grunt screams.
But yeah, the way it talks about PTSD is also, again, from my uninitiated and uninformed perspective, a bit hit and miss. Some of the early episodes are very compelling and very sympathetic. Some of the later stuff is a lot less so.
Yeah.
But overall, I think it was a good series and it's a good breath of fresh air after the lackluster Defenders and Iron Fist stuff.
It's also good for these, what you would call bankable shows, like the Marvel, you know, they're supposed to be bankable. They're on Netflix, right? They're supposed to get people to be engaged.
Yeah.
For them to try to do things.
Yeah.
Right?
And I think that I would be a lot less disappointed with the political stance of the show if Jessica Jones and Luke Cage both hadn't been so fucking good at that. Like, this is less good than that.
Yeah.
And the Defenders was also less good than that. And so I was just really hoping that it would come back up. But like we said, overall, still a really good show.
Definitely. Yeah. So our next TV show to talk about is Mr. Robot.
You've not seen Mr. Robot, have you?
I've watched almost all of season one.
Yeah.
And I really quite like it. I just, you know, when something just falls off the radar.
Yeah, yeah.
I gotta write it down on a list somewhere. There's a list somewhere with Mr. Robot on it.
So season one was back in 2015. We're talking about it because season three just wrapped up, I think, like a week ago as of recording.
Mm-hmm.
Mr. Robot is one of my favorite things ever. It is an amazing TV show. Sam Esmail is the showrunner, the artistic vision behind it. And every single time I watch an episode or think about an episode or have a passing fancy or a flashback to an episode, I am overwhelmed emotionally at how good it is and just how fucking good every part of it is.
Double fuck.
Yeah, it is just, it's amazing. Season one, if you're a fan of Fight Club, check this show out. Right?
Hold on. When you say, am I a fan of Fight Club, do I believe that men should form groups and violently fight each other? Or the looking into the subtext of male masculinity and...
I was talking mainly to the second group, but also the first group could afford to watch a show like this.
Get educated, boys.
Yeah, so the show is just very, very intelligent about... a lot of stuff. It's also, because it's about hackers. I know that's a crap way to sell the show, but it's got hacking in it.
Yeah. It's the same way that in House, they use medicine as like the mechanic, the underlying.
Yeah, except imagine something 100 times better than House.
Yeah.
So it is very, very clever in terms of its social exploration and political exploration and the stuff that they've got going on with the characters, the depths they go to.
Yeah.
The absolute depths they go to. Rami Malek plays.
The wonderful.
Yeah, the main character of Elliot Alderson. And they've got Christian Slater as Mr. Robot himself.
Mm.
So it's all...
Christian Slater, so good in this show. It's amazing.
It's incredibly well cast. And that's, like I said, every single element of it. In this isn't really a spoiler, but in the most recent season, there's a point where they do a bit of a flashback and cast a younger version of one of the characters. And that casting, it's just amazing. Like, it's one of those things where I look at this younger actor playing the younger version of this character and I'm like, how did they find someone? Yeah. How is there a person on the planet who is so good at capturing the performance of this full adult woman as a young child, you know?
Oh, yeah.
It's incredible. And just the cinematography and every element of the script.
If you want to watch a show that David absolutely adores.
If you want to watch a show that typifies what artistic television can be in the mainstream. Like, this is boundary pushing. Okay. Check it out.
Also, you could get into David's head a little more.
Yeah, maybe a little bit, but mainly the TV boundary pushing thing.
Yep. So Channel Zero is an anthology show in the vein of such things as... American Horror Story is the only anthology show I know, so...
Twilight Zone?
Twilight Zone, that's another one. But Channel Zero, the first...
Black Mirror...
The first season came out in 2016. The story was written by Chris Straub, and it was about...
Oh, really?
Yeah, it was... It's called Candle...
Candle Cove. Candle Cove. So this is the show that Candle Cove... So I'm a huge fan of Chris Straub.
Oh my God, David's getting really excited.
And I had no idea that this was the show that it was on.
Yeah, so Channel Zero is... It's an anthology show where they basically take creepypastas and stories like this.
Yeah.
Such as Candle Cove, which was the first season in 2016. And I watched... No End House, which is this year's version of the show. So this year's season.
Okay. So it was Candle Cove the whole season.
Yes.
All right. Okay.
It's like a five, I think it's 5 or 6 episode run.
Okay.
Yeah. So Candle Cove was the first season, but this season was No End House, which is another one of these stories from the web about a mysterious house that kids find out via odd YouTube videos and stuff.
This is such a good premise.
All right.
This is such taking internet folklore and turning it into television horror. That's brilliant.
And the No End House, like unfortunately, I do not want to talk about the show in any way. This is one of those shows where I would just ask you to watch the first episode blind. Like just jump into it, experience that, and Candle, I went back to watch Candle Cove, and I still quite liked it, but I feel like the No End House is really where the director involved with this series understood the idea and runs with it, and it's so off. It's like your favorite Twilight Zone episode extended over to 6 episodes with just wonderful character actors.
It's like typical horror though, right?
Yeah.
Or is it more like Twin Peaks-y kind of weird, what is happening with the camera right now? Why is this shot so long kind of horror?
It sits on both.
Okay.
Right? So it has your conventional... It starts with the No End House, which is kind of like a horror, like a spooky horror house. You go through it and there's all these weird, odd curiosities. But then the show starts to run after that.
Right.
And it gets weirder and stranger and just... escalates becomes this really odd world. And I want to tell people to go watch it because I just found it so...
This is literally the first I'm hearing about it and I desperately want to see it.
Yeah, it is amazing.
So you can't talk about horror in 2017 without talking about the landmark David Lynch television series, Twin Peaks.
I was so excited for this to come back. There's a place I always go to buy wonderfully delicious sandwiches and the people there were excited and we were all drinking like Twin Peaks themed drinks. I rewatched the original shows and the TV movie with David Bowie in it in preparation for this series to return.
I have tried watching Twin Peaks once in the past. I was off-put by the things in it that are supposed to be off-putting.
Yep.
And I didn't really understand the show because I would have been like 17 when I watched the original series. And it was before I really woke up to what art is in a full sense.
Yes.
So I have been meaning to go back and give it another go, but for obvious reasons, I haven't watched the 2017 series.
Oh.
And I would be so, again, like any reboot we've mentioned here, so interested to see what the intervening decades have done to the show.
So for me, it was wonderful to have watched the original show before going to this because you can see what the first season is. And this is kind of like pure Twin Peaks idea.
Mm.
And then the second season is where it gets kind of muddled and it goes a bit mainstreamy and it's a bit all over the place.
Okay.
And then there's a pause as David Lynch does everything else he did and made movies and music projects and just all kinds of nonsense.
Yeah.
And then he returned to make Twin Peaks, but on his terms. And he's not going to give you what you want. He's going to give you what you're going to get.
Yeah.
And the show is like intentionally expectation defying in such a wonderful way.
This is the thing. I've never heard a single person say a bad thing about it. Mm. Like when it was like the reboot of the X-Files last year, there are a lot of people who are very disappointed by it, but any person who says any word about the new Twin Peaks has only positive stuff to say about it.
I will say, I feel like sometimes it's intentionally obtuse, like overtly so.
Okay.
And that
is David Lynch though, isn't it?
No, this is true. And that's why I feel like a lot of people who are watching this are like, David Lynch, yes, please.
Yeah.
And when they watch, there's an episode mid-season that's just completely different to all the other ones. And you're you will know it when you see it, right? Mm. If you watch the show, you will know it. It stands out so distinctly. But
I want to go back to talking about Mr. Robot.
Yeah. No,
because everything you're saying, I really, really like. when the piece as a whole is something I have access to, you know?
And I feel like as the show is so pure in its vision, it could put people off. But I feel like it balances it well because no one's going to force themselves to watch the show because it's so obtuse unless they're willing to be invested. And if you're willing to be invested, you will gain something from it.
Yeah. No, I'm revitalized to try Twin Peaks again.
Oh, it is. The original series is it's kind of its time, even though it is of its time in the future.
My issue with it wasn't that it was dated, right? My issue was that when you have 3-minute scenes of Sarah Palmer's parents wailing, that I didn't get that that was supposed to be weird. And the fact that the show defies my expectations of the language of TV, of the construction of what TV is part of what makes it unsettling.
Yeah, yeah. It's just interesting to go back and revisit a show that's it's kind of an old show now, so.
Oh, definitely, yeah. Like 90s, right?
But I definitely would recommend watching all of it. Just, it's wonderfully put together and just some tour de force of TV. And if it's fucking, I think it's probably the most digestible stuff that David Lynch has made, so.
Wow, Jesus.
I think it's good.
So that's all of the TV that we have from 2017. There is one last style of artistic delivery we want to talk about.
One might say a higher style.
One could say that merely participating in the act of this art form makes one unto... Fuck, I ran out of shit to say.
That's fine. We're talking about podcasts. Yeah. Podcasts is what we're talking about. That's why we were doing the joke. Yeah, we're going to talk about a couple of podcasts. We've got one each that we just feel like was great and did a really wonderful job this year.
Yeah. Podcasts, there's way too many of them to really dive into deeply. Yeah. And because it's an ongoing commitment, it is theoretically an infinite commitment. You don't have wonderful season breaks that are constrained by production costs.
Yeah. You know, stopping points or... Anyway, the podcast I want to talk about, which I feel has been a tour de force of just wonderfully put together episodes and interesting things you can learn, is Reply All by Gimlet. They do internet news stories like nobody else.
Right.
Where they take things from the web, but not just things solely on the web, but stories that interface with the real world and our lives.
Okay.
Whether that's hackers or cryptocurrencies or scams or memes.
Yeah.
They have a segment that's called Yes, Yes, No, where their boss comes in with something he doesn't understand and they just dissect it for you.
Yeah.
And you get to learn about things like the frog meme.
Pepe.
Yeah. And Pizzagate and all of this stuff. And it's very interesting and informative.
See, that would be really good because I get a lot of my news of that kind from Twitter.
Yep.
And Twitter, by its very nature, is quick. You know, yes. I think it would be really good for me to sit down with something that's more considered. And, you know, I really want to start listening to more podcasts that are about learning. Because, I mean, a few years ago, I was on a big kick where I was just digesting every single YouTube series I could about stuff I didn't know about.
Yes.
And then there was a plateau in the middle there for, you know, sort of a, you know, I'm realizing now it's probably because I started this podcast at the time to just like troll through YouTube.
Yeah.
But yeah, I really want to try and include, like, Sawbones is one I started listening to recently, which is about medical history, which is a lot lighter in what its educational value is. But this sounds like really meaty and something that I, as a person who doesn't know as much about the internet as I probably should, at least the dark places of the internet and what the terrifying power of the internet, it seems like something I could really benefit from.
But they talk all kinds of stories. Like, they talk about a magician called Zardulu and all of the pizza rat conspiracy stuff. They do obscure things. They do new things. I think the latest episode, which to me it was the most typical of like the whole show, is it's called The Prophet.
Okay.
And they talk about how the internet is used as a tool by governments to influence our minds.
Yeah.
And they're talking about specifically a situation in Mexico where the government uses, like in Russia, the government uses groups of people to just spew static in the air. It's very interesting to hear about it.
So it's sort of like a opiate of the masses type thing.
Yeah. And they did a double episode on internet scams where they went to India to try and find the call center that was scamming Americans out of money for antivirus and stuff like that. They'll just take something and go way too far. For me, the funnest episode they did was a 48-hour call-in period where they let anyone call for 48 hours. They stayed up all night answering phone calls and you just get to hear the two hosts and it wonderfully conveys who they are as people and this just really personal experience.
Cool. Yeah. No, I mean, I want to check it out. So I'm definitely going to take a look at expanding my internet mind. So the podcast that I have, you may be familiar with, I have gushed about it in the past. I want to talk about The Adventure Zone.
Yeah.
So The Adventure Zone is a Dungeons & Dragons podcast, and the sudden uptick in the number of D&D podcasts is only rivaled by the sudden uptick in podcasts where the hosts also drink. So I understand it is an impenetrable sea at the moment, but honestly, this show is very unique. It's done by the McElroy brothers and the McElroy brothers' dad. They get together, they play D&D, it's
the
awesome.
The McEl family.
But the depth that they go to with the scope of the story is just amazing. And every little arc that they do one-ups the last one that they did. And to a point where you can't even believe it. The first arc is somewhat generic because they did it as a pilot out of just an adventure book.
Yeah.
So if you listen to one or two episodes and you don't really like it, my advice would be to stick with it, because by the end of the main story, they are doing shit that I don't expect from proper, fully budgeted television, you know? Mm. It is really powerful stuff. The person who's probably the most responsible for that of all of them is Griffin McElroy, who is worth watching for a whole bunch of reasons, but they're also just very positive, you know, socially conscious people, and a lot of very positive, like, representation is done in their work. And they have a couple of episodes where they talk about, you know, their behind the scenes of it, and just the level of thought that they put into that. So, minor spoiler, there is a trans character that shows up eventually. This is much later in the series, but she has been widely praised as a positive example of trans depiction in media by, among other people, Laura Dale, who is someone that we're both fans of.
Fantastic.
Yeah, so it's just a really lovely, positive, and massively interesting story. So if you have an opportunity, you're looking for something narrative based to check out, it's hard to top that as far as I'm concerned.
Fans of the show have started listening to this podcast after you've mentioned it.
Oh, really?
And have thoroughly enjoyed it.
Yeah, well, it doesn't surprise me.
Yep.
Now, that is all of the stuff from this grand old year that we actually
grand
had.
Old year, I got a song in.
That's a football thing, and fuck you, because it's gonna be in my head for 3 days. So those were all the things that we actually got a chance to look at. But there were some big things that we missed. Most notably, of course, video games, being that we are the slow, we are the pokes, and we did not get that many from this year done.
So, yeah. So I think of all the games this year, Destiny 2 stands out
as the game I most... I'm really curious where they take Destiny 2 after Destiny 1.
Yeah.
And the fact that Peter Dinklebot isn't in it anymore,
He's got to be in it somewhere as a bonus character. Sarcasm aside...
No, top of the list is Hellblade. Yeah, 100% top of the fucking list is Hellblade, Senua's Sacrifice. Yeah.
We should have played it. Like, we really should have.
We have, in a way, kind of prevented ourselves from being able to stay up to date because of the way we've constructed a play schedule for this show.
Yeah.
So when Hellblade came out, we were doing games that we were already behind on. And so it's a perpetual cycle.
It got added to the list.
I will say this. I don't like to make promises because, you know, sometimes we can't keep them. This is a promise we definitely can keep. That is next season. We are doing Hellblade Senua's Sacrifice.
Yes.
It won, like, I think it walked away from the Game Awards with the highest number of individual awards. There's just so much about the way it tackles mental health and all that kind of stuff. I'm desperate to play it.
It was widely praised. I'm really interested to check it out, so I look forward to playing that.
Another game that we're planning on doing in the future is What Remains of Edith Finch.
Yes.
That is the sequel to Unfinished Swan. Lots of good reasons we want to get into that one.
Oh.
Highly praised.
Yes, Unfinished Swan. I had such a great time with that game. I'm really interested to see what they can do next and what this game will portray, and just everything about it just looks so interesting.
I don't know what to expect. I just hear it's good.
Wolfenstein 2 is another game that I want to play, but I'm not 100% sure about it.
This is an academic curiosity for me.
Yeah.
We've done the first Wolfenstein, and it was, as far as I'm concerned, a mess.
Mm.
Like, it was doing a lot of stuff, and in my opinion, didn't do a lot of it well.
Yeah.
I'm interested to see what the sequel has done, especially because of the changing political climate regarding Nazis.
Yes. It'd be very interesting to explore it, I think.
PlayerUnknown's Battlegrounds was another one that we didn't get a chance to play.
Everyone else did.
Every
forever.
Single other human being on the planet has played this game. We haven't.
I set up a Twitch account, and it's just like, do you want to look at pub videos? They're everywhere.
Battle Royale as a concept doesn't really grab me. It just feels like a very gimmicky, very easy thing to grab for people who are already into it. But, you know, it's a cultural phenomenon. We have to take a look at it. One that I'm actually genuinely disappointed I haven't gotten to yet is Life is Strange
before
Storm, because Life is Strange is important to me for a number of reasons. It's an amazingly good game. It kind of made me rethink a lot of stuff.
Yep.
And it was one of the first episodes we did on this show.
It was, yeah.
So, big sad face from me.
After playing Shadow of Mordor, Shadow of War seems like a really interesting one to get into.
Yeah.
Except loot boxes, etc. So...
Yeah, Battlefront 2 has become such a political thing. Like, I'm not going to spend money on that game just because of the things surrounding it.
Yep.
And I don't know if Shadow of War, you know, voting with my wallet, etc., all of that kind of thing. But the first one, like you said, was very good. And the underlying game of Shadow of War, I hear, is also very good.
Yeah.
So
yeah, yeah.
Well, I don't know if I want to deprive myself of that.
That's true. Sexy Brutale looks great. It's got this beautifully a Venetian sort of mask art style-esque kind of thing going on. And it's all about using time powers to solve murders.
And coming out on Switch soon. So I'll get to play that in my pocket.
Yes, Pocket Plane is the best.
Yeah, but a cool little indie game that I really am disappointed that I didn't get a chance to get to yet.
So I'm a fan of the Resident Evil games, and I really want to see what Resident Evil 7 does, because it kind of is...
I can't put into words how little I care about Resident Evil as a whole. Great. I often forget it exists. The movies are more important culturally to me than the games.
That's wow. I don't know how to talk or comment on that, so I'm going to move swiftly on. Resident Evil, as someone who's played some of the other games, changes the formula, really revitalizes it, moves into a different style of horror that I'd be really interested in exploring more of. So I'm looking forward to actually catching up with that. It was genuinely like a big budget game that I was going to buy and play when it came out.
I don't know. Let me know, I guess. Maybe I'll care then. So we missed some movies from this year as well, and probably the one I'm the most interested in seeing is The Disaster Artist, which is the, I guess, the Seth Rogen, James Franco amalgamation of people.
It's based off a book on the movie.
Oh, I didn't know it was based on a book.
Yeah.
But the movie that it is, it's about Tommy Wiseau and the creation of The Room.
Yes, the weird character that is Tommy Wiseau, and it's a very odd movie.
And James Franco is apparently very compelling in that role, so interested to see that.
I always think James Franco, when you give him something to do, can do something with it. Now, Lady Bird's on this list. What's Lady Bird?
I have no idea. I just know I need to have seen it.
Oh, God. That's okay.
I think it's about millennials.
I don't know.
Everybody who's seen it says it's amazing, but nobody is talking about what it is.
That's usually a good sign.
Yeah, generally it is.
Or it's an hour and a half of propaganda brainwashing. So either Hypnotoad is going to be involved, or it'll be very compelling.
Shape of Water is sort of another one on that list. I don't know a lot about what it is, but I do know Guillermo del Toro.
Yeah. It looks so interesting. It has a very wonderful visual style, and it's also like about romance with a sea monster. And
okay, didn't know that. I've not seen a single frame of this.
Okay, well, I'm not going to say anything else apart from romance with a sea monster.
Also, Guillermo del Toro, though, is worth repeating.
Those are two things. Those are twice selling points for that movie.
So The Big Sick is another one I know nothing about, but it is a...
Autobiographical?
Yeah, autobiographical, I guess is the word for it, for the main actor in it, who is Kumail Nanjiani.
Mm-hmm.
He's been in a bunch of stuff. He's a very funny person, and his Twitter account is worth following, if nothing else. But yeah, again, I've only heard good things, but know nothing about it other than it's sort of a personal piece from him.
Yeah, it's really compelling, because it blends comedy and personal storytelling and all of that stuff together in what is apparently very compelling.
Do you want to see Ghost in the Shell?
Only intellectually, because I watched The Great Wall.
So you've seen Ghost in the Shell, the TV show, so I understand that. See, I've not seen the TV show, so I can't see that movie.
Yeah. So, no, you can't. You need to, there are things you must watch first.
I like ScarJo, but I cannot see that movie.
Yeah. So, intellectually, as like the ideas behind the West influencing other cultures and things like that, having watched The Great Wall and knowing about its history and how it was created, and also I want to watch Ghost in the Shell so I can talk about that and the studio behind that. Because The Great Wall, it was a Chinese film with Chinese director and made in China. And Ghost in the Shell was made in the US. Mm. And everybody on that list is American.
And there's a lot that I want to be able to talk about, but I can't do so without having seen the film first. You know what I'm trying to say? Like, there's a big conversation about whitewashing and Western influence, but that conversation will always be complete if you haven't seen the film itself.
Yeah, and I've watched the original film, and I've watched the show, like a lot of the show, and I've got all that experience. So I want to watch this film as well to complete like my knowledge base, so I don't talk completely uneducated about it as a point of comparison. So it's more of an intellectual curiosity for me.
So that's ultimately our journey through 2017. If there's anything we missed, feel free to let us know. You can find us on iTunes. Our website is slowpokespodcast.com. Twitter at slowpokescast and Facebook is facebook.com/slowpokespodcast. If there's anything from this year that you would recommend that we check out, let us know. If there's anything that we've said that we're interested in seeing that's absolute garbage and you want to try and protect us from that,
also let us know. Yeah, I mean, apart from the things that are intentionally garbage, like Ghost in the Shell, like I know that it's probably bad. Just let me watch.
It's been an interesting year. Some good stuff's happened. Some bad stuff's happened. We want to talk about it. We want to talk about it with you. So talk at to us with those things.
Yes.
Our next game will be next year.
Yes.
The exact date eludes me at the moment, but it is sometime in sort of mid-January.
Mm-hmm.
We'll be debuting season 3 with a game from this year that we missed, which is Horizon Zero Dawn.
Oh, so excited to talk about it.
Me too. I have actually started already and there is a lot to like about it. It was nominated for a bunch of game awards and I understand why. So look forward to that episode because I think it's going to be a good one.
Yes, but I think a fortnight when this comes out, it'll be New Year's and we will not have an episode because we'll be taking a break.
That. Yes. Yeah. We'll be, we are having a little bit of a breather, but check us out in
the new year.
And thank you so much for joining us for our last episode of this year. It's been an absolute privilege to be able to talk at you through electronic devices and the internet.
Mm-hmm.
This show wouldn't be what it is without y'all. So thanks.
Yes, and have a great 2018.
And holidays and stuff.
Yeah.
Bye.
Bye.